Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
I'm going to do an article on Carl Sagan, reading from the Wikipedia article. It generally tends to be rather good Wikipedia, my honest opinion. And I'm interested in Carl Sagan because there's some good quotes from him. He's a bit of a mystery to me. He's like a celebrity who's a legitimate scientist, has come up with ideas. So generally interested in him. And of course there's a pressure for me to be able to do a long grade podcast. So let's read about Carl Sagan, downloaded on the 2nd of the 2nd, 2020. Carl Edward Sagan, November 9th, 1934 to December 20th, 1996. And I suppose I'm interested in that he sort of has died pretty much my age. I'm 57, he's probably 62. Was an American astronomer, cosmologist, astrophysicist, astrobiologist, author, science popularizer, and science communicator in astronomy and other natural sciences. He's best known as a science popularizer and communicator. Again, his best known scientific contribution to research on extraterrestrial life, including experimental demonstration of the production of amino acids from basic chemicals by radiation. Carl Sagan assembled the first physical messages sent into space, the Pioneer plaque on the Voyager Golden Record, universal messages that could potentially be understood by any extraterrestrial intelligence that might find them. Carl Sagan argued the now accepted hypothesis that the high surface temperatures of Venus can be attributed to calculated to the greenhouse effect. I have people to say about that. He published more than 600 scientific papers and articles and was the author and co-author or editor of more than 20 books. He wrote many popular science books. Such as Dragons and Vegans, Broca's Brain, The Pale Blue Dot, and narrated and co-wrote the award-winning 1980 television series Cosmos, A Personal Voyage, the most widely watched series in the history of American public television. Cosmos has been seen by at least 500 million people across 60 different countries. The book Cosmos was published to accompany the series. He also wrote the science fiction novel Contact, the basis of the 1997 film of the same name. His papers containing 595,000 items were archived in the Public Library of Congress. Sagan advocated scientific skeptical inquiry and scientific method, pioneered exobiology and promoted the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I just wonder what the scientific method is. I mean, scientific method is basically quality control and the generation of new ideas beyond your current imagination, I suppose. He spent most of his career as a professor of astronomy at Cornell University, where he directed the Laboratory of Planetary Studies. Sagan and his works received numerous awards and honors, including the NASA's Distinguished Public Service Medal, the National Academy of Science Public Welfare Medal, Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction for his book The Dragon's Vegan, and regarding Cosmos, a personal villain, two Emmy Awards, a Peabody Award, a Hugo Award. He married three times, had five children, after suffering myelodysplasia, Sagan died of pneumonia, age 62, on December 20th, 1966. Early life and education. Carl Sagan was born in Brooklyn, New York. His father, Samuel Sagan, an immigrant garment worker from the Kamensk-Podilsky, then the Russian Empire, today the Ukraine. His mother, Rachel Molly Gerber, was a housewife in New York. Carl named in honor of Rachel's biological mother, Charlie Culler, in Sagan's words, the mother she never knew. He had a sister, Carol, and a family lived in a modest apartment near the Atlantic Ocean in Bensonhurst, a Brooklyn neighborhood. According to Sagan, they were Reformed Jews, the most liberal of North American Judaism's four major groups. Carl and his sisters agreed that their father was not especially religious, but their mother definitely believed in God and active in the temple and served only kosher meat. During the depth of the depression, his father worked as a theatre usher. He's obviously older than me. According to the biography, Keir Davison's account, his inner war was the result of his close... I don't quite understand this one. I suppose it's a religious war. With both his parents, who were both in many ways opposite Salkin traits, his later analytical urges to his mother, a woman who was extremely poor as a child in New York City during World War I in the 1920s. As a young woman, she had held her own intellectual ambitions, but they were frustrated by social restrictions to poverty, her status as a woman and a wife, her Jewish ethnicity. Davison notes she therefore worshipped her only son Carl, who would fulfill her unfulfilled dreams. However, he claimed that his sense of wonder came from his father. In his free time, gave his apples to the poor or helped soothe labour management tensions in New York's garment industries. Although he was awed by Carl's intellectual abilities, he took his son's inquisitive in stride and saw it as part of growing up. In his later years, as a writer and a scientist, Carl Sagan would often draw on his childhood memories to illustrate scientific points, as he did in his book Shadows of the Forgotten Ancestors. Sagan describes his parents' influence on his later thinking. My parents were not scientists. They knew most nothing about science, but in introducing me simultaneously to skepticism and to wonder, they taught me two of the most uneasily cohabiting modes of thought that are central to the scientific method. And it's beautiful. Skepticism and wonder. Skeptical wonder. Sagan recalls that one of his most defining moments was when his parents took him to the 1939 New York World Fair when he was 4 years old. The exhibits became a turning point of his life. He later recalled the moving map of the Americans of Tomorrow's exhibit. It showed beautiful highways, clover leaves and little General Motors cars, all carrying people to skyscrapers, building with lovely spires, flying buttresses that looked great. At other exhibits, he remembered how a flashlight that shone on the photoelectric cell created a crackling sound, and how the sound from him, a tuning fork, became a wave and oscilloscope. He also witnessed the future media technology that would replace the radio, television, Sagan wrote. Plainly, the world held wonders of a kind I never guessed. How could a tone become a picture and light become a noise? Gee, my kids are uninspired. He also saw one of the fair's most prized events, the burial of a time capsule at Flushing Meadows, with the contained mementos of the 1930s recovered by the Earth's descendants in the future millennium. The time capsule would thrill Carl, wrote Setson. As an adult, Carl Sagan and his colleagues would create similar time capsules that were sent into the galaxies. There was the Pioneer Plaque, the Voyage and Goyle record, Precis, all of which were spin-offs to Carl Sagan's memories of the World Fair. During the Second World War, Sagan's family worried about the fate of the European relatives. Sagan, however, was generally aware of the details of the ongoing war. He wrote, "Sure, we had relatives who were caught up in the Holocaust. Hitler was not a popular fellow in the household. But on the other hand, I was fairly insulated from the horrors of war." His sister, Carol, said to his mother, "Above all, wanted to protect Carl. She had an extraordinarily difficult time dealing with World War II and the Holocaust." Sagan's book, The Demon Haunted World, 1996, included his memories of a conflicted period where his family dealt with the realities of the war in Europe but tried to prevent it from undermining his optimistic spirit. Inquisitive about nature. Soon after entering elementary school, he began to express a strong inquisitive about nature. Sagan recalled taking his first trips to the public library alone at the age of 5. When his mother got him a library card, he wanted to learn what stars were, since none of his friends or parents could give him an answer. Quote, "I went to the librarian and asked for a book about stars. The answer was stunning. It was that the sun was a star, but really close. The stars were suns, but so far away they were just little points of light. The scale of the universe suddenly opened up to me. It was a kind of religious experience. There was a magnificence to it, grandeur, a scale which never left me. It never left me alone." I'd be sad. I wouldn't mind, he's dead, but it would have been good to write to him. He would have helped me out. About the age of 6 or 7, he and his close friend took trips to the American Museum of Natural History across the East River to Manhattan. While there, they went to the Hayden Planetarium and walked around the museum's exhibits of space objects such as meteorites and displays of dinosaurs and animals in natural settings. Sagan writes about those visits. I was transfixed by the dioramas, lifelike representations of animals and their habitats all over the world. Penguins on a dimly lit Antarctic ice, a family of gorillas, a male beating his chest, an American grizzly bear standing on its hind legs 10 or 12 feet tall and staring right at me right in the eye. His parents helped nurture his growing interest in science by buying him chemistry sets and reading materials. Yeah, Dad got me chemistry sets. CSR Roy was throwing out all the chemicals and gathering them up. His interest in space, however, was the primary focus, especially after reading science fiction stories such as writers H.G. Wells, Edgar Rice Burroughs, which stirs the imagination about life on other planets such as Mars. According to the biographer Ray Sprangberg, these early years, as Sagan tried to understand the mysteries of the planets, became a driving force of his life, a continual spark of his intellect, the quest never forgotten. In 1947, he discovered the Astounding Science Fiction magazine, which introduced him to some more hard science fiction speculations than those of Burroughs' novels. That same year, inaugurated Flying Saucer, Mass Hysteria, with the young Carl suspecting the disc might be alien ships, high school years. That's good. There's actual numbers on the pages. Good. I'm glad I've put that here. It's the right knob. Sagan lived in Bensonhurst, where he went to the David A. Booty Junior High School. He had a bar mitzvah in the Bensonhurst when he turned 13. The following year, in 48, his family moved to the nearby town of Rye, New Jersey, for his father's work. With Sagan then entered the Rahway High School. He graduated in 51. Rahway was an older industrial town, and the Sagans were among the few Jewish families. Sagan was a straight-A student, but was bored due to the unchallenging classes and uninspiring teachers. His teachers realised this and tried to convince his parents to send him to a private school, the administrators telling them the kid ought to go to school for gifted children as something really remarkable. They can't do it, partly because of the cost. And no end quotes there. Oh, yeah. That they couldn't do it partly because of the cost. Sagan was made president of the school's chemistry club. At the home, he set up his own laboratory. He taught himself about molecules by making cardboard cutouts of them to visualize how the molecules were formed. I found that about as interesting as doing chemical experiments, he said. Sagan remained mostly interested in astronomy as a hobby. And in his junior year, made a career goal after he learned that astronomers were paid for doing what he always enjoyed. That's a splendid day when I began to suspect that if I tried hard, I could do astronomy full-time, not just part-time. Before the end of high school, he entered an essay contest in which he posed the question of whether human contact with advanced life forms from another planet might be disastrous for people on Earth, as it was for the Native Americans when they first had contact with the Europeans. The subject was considered controversial, but his rhetorical skill won over the judges, and they awarded him first prize. By graduation, his classmates had voted him the most likely to succeed and put him in line to be a valedictorian. University education. Sagan attended the University of Chicago, which was one of the few colleges he applied that would consider admitting a 16-year-old despite his excellent high school grades. His chancellor, Robert Hutchins, structured the school as an ideal meritocracy with no age requirement. The school was employed a number of nation's leading scientists, including Enrico Fermi, Edward Teller, along with other operating the famous Yerkes Observatory. During his time as an honors program undergraduate, Sagan worked at the laboratory of geneticist H.J. Muller and wrote a thesis on the origins of life with physical chemist Harold Urey. Sagan joined Ryerson Astronomical Society, received a BA degree in laughingly self-proclaimed nothing, with generally in special honours in 54, a BS degree in physics in 55. He went on to earn an MS degree in 56 before earning a PhD in 1916 for his thesis, Physical Studies of Planets, submitted to the Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics. He used the summer months of his graduate studies to work on his dissertation director, planetary scientist Gerard Krupier, the Krupier Bell, I suppose, as well as the physicist George Gamow and the chemist Melvin Kelvin. The title of Sagan's dissertation reflects his shared interest with Krupier, who throughout the 50s and had been president of the International Astronomy Union's Commission, Physical Studies of Planets and Satellites. In 58, two worked on a classified military project, A-119, a secret Air Force plan to detonate a nuclear warhead on the moon. How stupid is that? Sagan had a top secret clearance to the US Air Force and a secret clearance with NASA. While working on his doctoral dissertation, Sagan revealed US government classified titles of the two Project A-119 papers when he applied for the University of California Berkeley Scholarship. The leak was not publicly revealed until 1999 when it was published in the Journal of Nature. A follow-up letter in the journal by the project leader, Leonard Refor, confirmed Sagan's security leak. A bit stupid, isn't he? In 1960-62, Sagan, as Miller Fellow at the University of California, Berkeley, meanwhile, he published an article in 61 in the journal Science on the atmosphere of Venus while working with NASA's Mariner 2 team and served as a planetary sciences consultant to the RAND Corporation Research and Development. After the publication of Science article in 61, Harvard University astronomers Fred Wimple and Donald Menzel offered Sagan the opportunity to give a colloquium at Harvard, and subsequently offered him a lecturer position in the institution. Sagan instead asked to be made assistant professor. Eventually, Wimple and Menzel were able to convince Harvard to offer Sagan the assistant professor position he requested. Sagan lectured, performed research, and advised graduate students in the institution from 63 to 68, when he was working at the Siebonian Astrophysical Observatory, also the Cambridge, Massachusetts. In 68, Sagan was denied tenure at Harvard. He later indicated the decision was very much unexpected. The tenure denial has been blamed for several factors, including his focused interest too broadly across a number of areas, while the norm of academia has become a renowned expert in a narrow speciality. And perhaps because of his well-publicized scientific advocacy, which some scientists perceived as borrowing ideas from others for little more than self-promotion. An advisor from his years in undergraduate students, Harold Earle, wrote a letter to the tenure committee recommending strongly tenure for Sagan. Here's a quote from Sagan. "Science is more than a body of knowledge. It's a way of thinking. I have a foreboding of an America in my children's or grandchildren's time, where the United States is a service and information economy, where nearly all the key manufacturing industries have slipped away to other countries, when awesome technological powers are in the hands of very few, and no one representing public interest can even grasp the issues, when the people have lost the ability to set their own agendas or knowledgeability. I don't know what that means. Long before the ill-fated tenure process, Cornell astronomer Thomas Gold had courted Sagan to move to Ithaca, New York, and join the faculty at Cornell. Following the denial of tenure from Harvard, Sagan accepted Gold's offer and remained at faculty in Cornell for up to 30 years until his death in 96. Unlike Harvard, the smaller and more laid-back astronomy department at Cornell welcomed Sagan's growing celebrity status. Following 2 years as an associate professor, Gold became a full professor at Cornell in 1970 and directed the Laboratory of Planetary Studies there. From 92 to 81, he was Associate Director of the Center for Radiophysics and Spatial Research, CRISPR, at Cornell. In 1996, he became the David Duncan Professor of Astronomy and Space Sciences, a position he held for the remainder of his life. Oh, here's the end quote. Sorry, this goes over. The question of their authority. And when clutching our crystals and nervously consulting our horoscopes, our critical faculties decline, unable to distinguish between feel goods and what true, we slide almost without noticing back into superstition and darkness. I think that's happening here in Australia. Sagan was associated with the US space program from its inception. From the 50s onwards, he worked as an advisor to NASA, where one of his duties was to include briefing the Apollo astronauts before the flights to the moon. Sagan contributed many of his robotic spacecraft missions to explore the solar system, arranging experiments on many expeditions. Sagan assembled the first physical message to be sent to space, the gold-plated plaque attached to the Space Pioneer probe, Pioneer 10, launched in 72. Pioneer 11, also carrying another copy of the plaque, was launched the following year. He continued to refine his designs. The most celebrated message he he helped develop and assemble was the Voyager Gold Record, which was sent out with the space voyage and the probes of 77 of Voyager Pioneer. Sagan often challenged the decisions to fund the space shuttle and the International Space Station as an expense of further robotic missions. There you go. It really doesn't matter, does it? Scientific achievements. Former student David Morris describes Sagan as an idea person and master of intuitive physical argument and back-of-the-envelope calculations. And Jared Cooper said that some persons work best in specialising on major programs in a laboratory, others are best in liaisons between scientists. Dr. Sagan belongs to the latter group. He's just a liaison person. Sagan's contributions were central to the discovery of the high surface temperatures of Venus. In the early 1960s, no one knew for certain the basic conditions of Venus's surface, and Sagan listed the possibilities in a report later depicted for the popularisation of the Time Life book, Planets. His own view is Venus was a dry, very hot, and it was as opposed to the balmy paradise others had imagined. He investigated radio waves from Venus and concluded that the surface temperature was 500 degrees Celsius. As a visiting scientist to NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, he contributed the first Mariner missions to Venus, working on designs and management of the project. Mariner 2 confirmed the conclusions on the surface of the conditions of Venus in 1962. Sagan was among the first to hypothesize that Saturn's moon Titan might possess oceans of liquid compounds on the surface of Jupiter's moon, Europa, might possess subsurface oceans of water. This could make Europa's potentially habitable. Europa's subsurface ocean of water was later indirectly confirmed by the spacecraft Galileo. The mystery of Titan's reddish haze was solved with Sagan's help. British haze was revealed due to complex organic molecules constantly raining down from Titan's surface. That's organic means it's just a carbon, hydrocarbons, not necessarily of life form. Sagan further contributed insights regarding to the atmospheres of Venus and Jupiter. That's right. I'm just checking my dictaphone is going here. It'd be rather sad if it wasn't. He also perceived global warming as a growing man-made danger. He likened to the natural development of Venus into a hot, life-hostile planet through a kind of runaway greenhouse effect. Sagan and his Cornwall colleague Edwin Ernest Salpeter speculated about life on Jupiter's cloud, but given the planet's dense atmospheric composition and rich organic molecules, he studied and observed colour variations in Mars' surface and concluded they were not seasonal vegetation that changes, as most believe, but shifts in the dust caused by windstorms. Sagan is also known for his research on the possibility of extraterrestrial life, including experimental demonstration production of amino acids from basic chemicals by radiation. He was also, in 1994, the recipient of the Public Welfare Medal for the highest award for the National Academy of Sciences for distinguished contributions to the application of science to public welfare. He was denied membership to the Academy, reportedly because his media activities made him unpopular with many of the other scientists. In 2017, which is Sagan is the most cited SETI scientist and one of the most cited planetary scientists. Oh, well, there you go. Cosmos, popularizing science on TV. In 1980, Sagan co-wrote and narrated the award-winning 13-part PBS public series Cosmos, A Personal Voyage, which became the most widely watched series in the history of American public television. The show has been seen at least by 500 million people across 60 different countries. The book Cosmos, written by Sagan, was published as the company of the series. Because of his early popularity as a science writer from his best-selling books, including The Dragon's Egan, which won him the Pulitzer Prize in 77, He was asked to write and rate the show. It targeted at the general audience of viewers, who Sagan felt had lost interest in science, partly due to the stifled education system. Each of the 13 episodes was created to focus on a particular subject or person, thereby demonstrating the synergy of the universe. They covered a wide range of scientific subjects, including the origin of life and perspective of humans' place on Earth. The show won an Emmy, along with a Peabody Award, and transformed Sagan into obscure astronomy into a pop culture icon. Time magazine ran a cover story on Sagan soon after the show progressed, referring to him as creator, chief writer, and host narrator of the show. In 2000, Cosmos was released on remastered DVDs. Billions and Billions. Sagan was invited to frequent appearance on The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson. After Cosmos aired, he became associated with the catchphrase Billions and Billions. Although he never actually used the phrase in the Cosmos series, he rather used the term Billions upon Billions. Carson, however, would sometimes use the phrase during his parodies of Sagan. As humorous a tribute to Sagan, his association with the catchphrase Billion Billions, a Sagan has been defined as a unit of measurement equivalent to a very large number, technically at least 4 billion, 2 billion plus 2 billion of anything. Okay, well. Now what page? It's 4.7. Coming on to 5 out of 17. Oh my god, I've only put 10. Scientific and critical thinking advocacy. Sagan's ability to convey ideas allowed many people to understand the cosmos better, simultaneously emphasizing the value and worthiness of the human race and a relative insignificance of the Earth in comparison to the universe. He delivered the 1977 series, The Royal Institution of Christmas Lectures in London. Sagan was a proponent of the search for extraterrestrial life. He argued scientific community to listen with radio telescopes for signals and the potential intelligence of extraterrestrial life forms. Sagan was so persuasive by 1982, he was able to get a petition advocating SETI published in a journal of science, signed by 70 scientists, including 7 Nobel Prize winners. This signaled a tremendous increase in receptivity of the then controversial field. Sagan helped Frank Drake write the Arecibo message, a radio message beamed to space. The Arecibo radio telescope in November 16, 1974, aimed at informing potential extraterrestrials about Earth. Sagan was the chief technology officer for the professorial planetary research journal ARCRIS for 12 years. He co-founded the Planetary Society and was a member of the SETI Institute Board of Trustees. Sagan served as chairman of the Division of the Planetary Science American Astronomy Society. As president of the Planetology Section of the American Geophysical Union and chairman of the Astronomy Section of the American Association of Advancement of Science. Oh my god, father. At the heart of the Cold War, Sagan became involved in the nuclear disarmament efforts by promoting hypotheses on the effects of nuclear war. When Paul Crutzen, The Twilight at Noon concept, suggested that substantial nuclear exchange would trigger nuclear twilight and upset delicate balance of life on Earth by cooling the surface. In 1983, he was one of the 5 known authors of the S, the follow-up, follow-up TARPS model. As a research article came to be known, which contained the first use of nuclear winter, he and his colleagues P. Tocker had coined. In 1984, he co-authored the book Cold and Dark, World After Nuclear War. In 1990, the book The Path Where No Man Thought, Nuclear Winter and the End of the Arms Race, which explains the nuclear winter hypothesis and advocates nuclear disarmament. Sagan received a great deal of skepticism and disdain for the use of media to disseminate the very uncertain hypothesis. It was really interesting that nuclear winter was only going to hit the Northern Hemisphere. The Southern Hemisphere would get off unscathed. Almost no effect on the Southern Hemisphere. A personal correspondence with nuclear physicist Edward Teller around 83 began amicably, with Teller expressing support for continued research to ascertain the credibility of winter hypothesis. However, Sagan and Teller's correspondence would ultimately result in Teller writing, A propagandist is one who uses incomplete information to produce maximum persuasion. I can prompt you on being indeed an excellent propagandist, remembering that a propagandist is one of the better, the less he appears to be one. Oh, brilliant. Biographers of Sagan would also comment that from a scientific viewpoint, the nuclear winter was a low point for Sagan, although politically speaking, it popularized his image amongst the public. Gee. An adult Sagan remained a fan of science fiction, although disliking stories that were not realistic, such as ignoring the inverse square law, or, he said, did not include a thoughtful pursuit of alternative future. He wrote books to popularize science, such as Cosmos, which reflected and expanded upon the themes of personal voyage. It became the best-selling science book ever published in English. The Dragons of Egan, Speculations of the Evolution of Human Intelligence, which won the Pulitzer Prize, and The Brocker Brain, Reflections on Ruins of Science. Sagan also wrote the best-selling science fiction novel Contact in 1985, based on a film treatment he wrote with his wife, and died in 1979. He did not live to see the book in a motion picture adaptation. Starred Jodie Foster and won the 88 Hugo Award for Best Dramatic Presentation. Sagan wrote a sequel to Cosmos, Pale Blue Dot, A Vision of the Blue Future from Space, which he selected as a notable book in 1995, The New York Times, and appeared in PBS Charlie Rose program in January 1995. Sagan also wrote the introduction to Stephen Hawking's bestseller, A Brief History of Time. I think it was an awful book. It just makes me rip my tonsils out and vomit. Sagan was also known for the popularization of science, his efforts to increase scientific understanding among the general public, and his positions in favor of scientific skepticism and against pseudoscience. This is debunking the Betty Barney Hill abduction. To mark the 10th anniversary of Sagan's death, David Morrison, a former student of Sagan, called Sagan's immense contribution to planetary research, the public understanding of science, and the skeptical movement in the Skeptical Inquirer. Following Saddam Hussein's threats to light Kodak oil wells on fire in response to any physical challenge to Iraq, control the oil assets, Sagan, together with his TAPS colleagues, Paul Crewson, warned the 1981 Baltimore Sun and Wilmington Star newspapers that if the fires were left to burn over a period of several months, enough smoke from 600 or so 1991 oil fires might get high up to disrupt agriculture in much of South Asia, and that possibility should affect the war plans. The claims were also subject to a televised debate between Sagan and physicist Fred Singer on January 22, aired on ABC News program Nightline. In the televised debate, Sagan argued that the effects of smoke would be similar to the effect of a nuclear winter, Singer arguing the contrary. After the debate, the fires burnt for many months before extinguishment efforts were complete. The results of the smoke did not produce a continental-sized cooling. Sagan later considered in The Demon Haunted the Well, the prediction did not turn out to be correct. It was pitch black at noon, and the temperatures dropped 4 to 6 degrees over the Persian Gulf, but not much smoke reached the altitudes, and Asia was spared. In his later years, Sagan advocated the creation of organized search for asteroids, near-Earth objects, that might impact Earth, but also forestall and postpone developing the technological methods that would be needed to defend against them. He argued that all of the numerous methods proposed to alter the orbit of asteroids, including employment of nuclear detonation, created a deflection dilemma. If the ability to deflect an asteroid away from Earth exists, then one also have the ability to divert a non-threatening object towards Earth, creating an immensely destructive weapon. In 1994 paper he co-authored, he ridiculed a three-day-long near-Earth object interception workshop held by the Los Alamos Astronomy LAN, and did not even in passing state such interception or deflection technologies would these ancillary dangers. That's actually quite a very good point, especially if you're a Yank. I think most people think that's quite good. Sagan remained hopeful that the natural NEO impact threat and intrinsically double-edged essence of the methods to prevent the threats would serve as a new and potential motivation to maturing international relations. Later acknowledging that with sufficient international oversight, in the future, a work-our-way-up approach to implementing nuclear explosive deflection methods could be fielded when sufficient knowledge was gained to use them to aid in mining asteroids. His interest in the use of nuclear detonations in space grew out of his work in 1958 for the Armour Research Foundation Project A119 concerning the possibility of detonating a device on the nuclear on the lunar surface. Sagan was a critic of Pluto, having said that ancient Greek philosopher science and mathematics were removed from the hands of the merchants and artisans. This tendency found the most effective advocate followers of Pythagoras, named Plato. And I don't quite understand, that's page 5 of finished. I don't know how this goes together. Here's a quote from Carl Sagan. He, Plato, believed that ideas were far more real than the natural world. Yes, formation. Yeah, the form. He advised astronomers not to waste their time observing the stars and planets. It was better, he believed, just to think about them. Plato expressed hostility to observation and experiment. He taught contempt to the real world, disdain to the practical application of scientific knowledge. Plato's followers succeeded in extinguishing the light of science and experiment that have been linked to Democritus. He doesn't really know much about. But, yeah, I think that's a bit much. Popularizing science, speaking as the forms, I suppose. This is intellectualizing. Speaking about his activities in popularizing science, Sagan began that there were at least two reasons for scientists to share the purpose of science with its contemporary state. Simple self-interest was one. Much of the funding of science came from the public, and the public therefore had the right to know how the money was being spent. If scientists increased public admiration for science, there was a good chance of having more public supporters. The other reason was the excitement of communicating one's own excitement about science to others. Criticisms. While Sagan was widely adored by the general public, his reputation in the scientific community was more polarized. Critics sometimes characterized his work as fanciful, non-rigorous, self-aggrandizing. Others complained in his later years that he neglected his role as faculty member to force the celebrity status. One of Sagan's harshest critics was Harold Urey, felt that Sagan was getting too much publicity for a scientist and was treating some scientific theories too casually. Urey and Sagan were said to have different philosophies of science, according to Davidson, while Urey was an old-time empiricist who avoided theorizing about the unknown. Sagan was, contrast, willing to speculate openly about such matters. Fred Wimple wanted Harvard to keep Sagan there, but learned that because Urey was a Nobel laureate, his opinion was an important factor in Harvard denying Sagan tenure. Sagan's Harvard friend, Lester Grinspoon, also said, "I know Harvard well enough to know there are people who certainly do not like people to be outspoken." Here's a quote. "When you turned, there was one astronomer being quoted on everything, one astronomer whose face you see on TV, and one astronomer whose books had the preferred display spot in the local bookstore. Everywhere, wherever you turn." Some, like Urey, later became to realise Sagan's popular brand of scientific advocacy was beneficial to science as a whole. Urey especially liked Sagan's 77 book, The Dragons of Aiken, and wrote Sagan's with his opinion, "I like it very much, and I'm amazed by someone like you has such an intimate knowledge of the various features of the problem. Congratulate you, you are a man of many talents." Sagan was accused of borrowing some ideas from others for his own benefits and countered the claims by explaining that the misappropriation was an unfortunate side effect as his role of science communicator and explainer, and that he attempted to give proper credit wherever possible. Social concerns. Sagan believed The Drake equation on substitution of original estimates suggested that there was a large number of extraterrestrial civilizations would form, but the lack of evidence of such civilizations highlighted by the Fermi paradox suggests technological civilizations seldom to self-destruct. This stimulated his interest in identifying and publicizing the ways that humanity could destroy itself, with the hope of avoiding the cataclysm which eventually becoming a spacefaring species. Sagan's deep concern regarding the potential destruction of human civilization and nuclear holocaust was conveyed in a memorable cinematic sequence of the final episode of Cosmos, called Who Speaks for Earth? Sagan had already resigned from the US the Air Force Scientific Advisory Board, USO Investigating Condon Committee, and voluntarily surrendered his top secret clearance in the process of the Vietnam War. Following his marriage to his third wife, novelist Anne Duran, in June 81, Sagan became more politically active, particularly in opposing the escalation of the nuclear arms race under President Ronald Reagan. In March 83, Reagan announced the Strategic Defense Initiative, a multi-billion-dollar project to develop comprehensive defense against attack by nuclear missiles, which was quickly dubbed the Star Wars program. Sagan spoke out against the project, arguing that it was technically impossible to develop a system with the level of protection required, and far more expensive to build such a system than it would be for an enemy to defeat it through decoys and other means, and that its construction would seriously destabilize the nuclear balance between the United States and Soviet Union, making further progress to nuclear disarmament impossible. I think so. Isn't that fundamentally, it's in terms of it costs $500 to send up a missile and $5 billion to stop it, and then I can just build 10 more missiles. When the Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev declared a unilateral moratorium on testing nuclear weapons, which would begin in August 85, in 40th anniversary of the atomic bomb of Hiroshima, Reagan administration dismissed the dramatic move as nothing more than propaganda and refused to follow suit. In response, the US anti-nuclear and peace activists staged a series of protests in Nevada test site, beginning on Easter Sunday 86 and continuing to 87. Hundreds of people in Nevada this experience group were arrested, including Sagan, who was arrested on two separate occasions as he climbed over a chain-link fence at the test site during the underground Operation Charity, the United States' Muskegon nuclear test series detonation. Sagan was also a vocal advocate of the controversial notion of testosterone poisoning, arguing that in 1992 that human males would become gripped by an unusually severe case of testosterone poisoning, which compelled them to become genocidal. What? In his review, Moondance magazine, writer Delia Gossip of 1990 Books, Women at War, he argues that females are only half of humanity, untainted by testosterone poisoning. The other chapter of his 1993 book, Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, he dedicated to testosterone and its alleged poisonous effect. I like it. Testosterone poisoning, isn't it amazing? It's beautiful. That's a beautiful thought. That's page 7. Personal life and belief. Sagan was married 3 times. In 57, he married biologist Lynn Margus. The couple had 2 children, Jeremy and Dorian Sagan. After Carl Sagan and Margus' divorce, he married artist Linda Salzman in 86. They also had a child together, Nick Sagan. During these marriages, Carl Sagan focused heavily on his career, a factor which may have contributed to Sagan's first divorce. In 81, Sagan married the author Anne Duran, and later they had 2 children, Alexander and Samuel Sagan. Carl Sagan and Duran remained married until death in 1996. He lived in an Egyptian revival house in Ithaca, perched on the edge of a cliff that formerly had been the headquarters of the Cornell Secret Society. Daughter Alexandra, also known as Sasha, published a book in 2019 on her father's Barnaby's legacy. The skepticism does not mean pessimism. Here's a quote from Isaac Asimov, letter to Sagan. I've just finished The Cosmic Connection and loved every word of it. You are my idea of a good writer because you have an unmanned style, and I've read, and when I read what you write, I hear you talking. One thing about the book made me nervous. It was entirely too obvious that you are smarter than I am. I hate that. Isaac Asimov described Sagan as one of the only two people he'd ever met whose intellect surpassed his own. The other, he claimed, was a computer scientist, an artificial intelligence, Marvin Minsky. Oh, that's so stupid. Whoa, who cares? Sagan frequently wrote about religion, the relationship between religion and science, expressing his scepticism about the conventional conceptualization of God as a sapient being, for example. Some people think of God as an outsized, light-skinned male and a long white beard sitting on a throne somewhere up in the sky, busy telling up the fall of every sparrow. Others, for example, Baruch Spinoza and Albert Einstein, consider God to be essentially the sum total of physical laws which describe the universe. I'll have to see what Spinoza is. I do not know of any compelling evidence for the anthropomorphic patriarchs controlling human destiny from some hidden celestial vantage point, but it would be a madness to deny the existence of physical laws. No, dear. In another description of his viewpoint of the concept of God, Sagan wrote, "The idea that God is an oversized white male with a flowing beard who sits in the sky until he's full of his sparrow is ludicrous. But if by God one means a set of physical laws that govern the universe, then clearly there is such a God. The God is emotionally unsatisfying. It does not make much sense to pray to a law of gravity." On atheism, Sagan commented in 81, "An atheist is someone who is certain that God does not exist, someone who has compelling evidence against the existence of God. I know of no such compelling evidence because God can be relegated to remote times and places and to ultimate causes. We would have to know a great deal more about the universe than we know to be sure that no God exists. To be certain, the existence of God and the non-existence of God seem to me a confident extremes on the subject, so riddled with doubt and uncertainty as to inspire very little confidence indeed." Sagan also commented on Christianity and the Jefferson Bible, stating, this is one of what the Jefferson Bible is, I think the Jefferson Bible, he took out the, it's edited, stating, "My long-term view about Christianity is it represents an amalgam of two seemingly mystical parts, the religion of Jesus and the religion of Paul. Thomas Jefferson attempted to exercise the Pauline parts of the New Testament. There isn't much left when it's done, but it's an inspiring document." Regarding, I have to see what the Jefferson Bible is again. "Regarding spirituality and relationship between with science, sacred state, spirit, some comes from the Latin word to breathe. What we breathe is air, which is certainly matter, however thin. Despite usage to the contrary, there is no necessary implication in the word spiritual that we are talking about anything other than matter, including matter inside the brain is made of, or anything outside the realm of science. On occasion, I will feel free to use the word. Science is not only compatible with spirituality, it's a profound source of spirituality. When we recognize our place in the immense light years and the passage of ages, we grasp at the intricacy, beauty, and subtlety of life that we're sorely feeling. A sense of elation and humility combined with it is surely spiritual." An environmental appeal, preserving, cherishing Earth, signed by Sagan and other noted scientists in 1990, stated that the historical record makes it clear religious teaching, example, and leadership are powerfully able to influence personal conduct and commitment. Thus, there is a vital role for religion and science. Coming to the end, I hope. In reply to a question in 1996 about his religious beliefs, Sagan answered, "I'm agnostic." Sagan maintained that the idea of the creator God on the universe was difficult to prove or disprove, and that the only conceivable scientific discovery that could challenge it would be an indefinitely old universe. Sagan's view on religion had been interpreted by a form of pantheism capable to answer a belief in Spinoza's God. His son, Dorian Sogan, said, "My father believed in God of Spinoza and Einstein, God not behind nature, but as nature, equivalent to it." His last wife, Anne Dorland, stated, "When my husband died, he was so famous and known for not being a believer. Many people would come up to me, still sometimes happen, and ask me if Carl changed at the end and converted his belief to the afterlife. They also frequently ask me if I think I will see him again. Faced with his death with unflagging courage and never sought refuge in the illusions, the tragedy was that we knew we would never see each other again. I don't ever expect to be reunited with Carl." In 2006, Anne Duran edited Sagan's Glasgow and Guildford Lectures in Natural Theology into a book, Varieties of Scientific Experience, A Personal View and a Search for God, in which she elaborates his views on the divinity of the natural world. Sagan is also well regarded as a free thinker or skeptic. One of the most famous quotations in Cosmos was, "Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence," such as Sagan standard by some. This is based on a nearly identical statement by his fellow founder of the Committee of Scientific Investigation and Claims and Paranormal, Zol Tuzi. "An extraordinary claim requires extraordinary proof." Okay. The idea had been early aphorized by Theodore Florent's work from India to planet Mars in 1899, from a longer quote by Pierre Laplace, a French mathematician and astronomer. "The weight of evidence should be proportional to the strangeness of the facts." Isn't that beautiful? Later in his life, Sagan's book elaborated his naturalist view of the world. In The Demon-Haunted World, he presented tools for testing arguments and detecting fallacious fraudulent ones, essentially advocating wide use of critical thinking and scientific method. The companions, the compilation Billions and Billions, Thoughts and Life and Death at the Brink of a Millennium, published in 1987, after Sagan's death, contains essays written by Sagan as his view on abortion, as well as the account by his widow and Dryden of his death in relation to having been agnostic and a freethinker. Sagan warned against Hume's tendency towards anthropocentrism. He was a faculty advisor to Cornell students in the ethical treatment of animals. In Cosmos chapter, Blues for the Red Planet, Sagan wrote, "If there is life on Mars, I believe we should do nothing with Mars. Mars then belongs to the Martians, even if the Martians are only microbes." Sagan was a user advocate of marijuana. Under the pseudonym Mr. X, he contributed an essay about smoking cannabis in 1971 to the book of Maharana's Reconsidered, Marijuana Reconsidered. The essays explained marijuana had helped inspire some of Sagan's work and enhance the sensual intellectual experiences. After Sagan's death, his friend Lester Crossland disclosed this information to Sagan's biographer Key Davison. Publishing the biography Carl Sagan's Life in 1999 brought the media attention to the aspect of Sagan's life. Not long after his death, his widow Anne Duran went outside to preside over the board of directors of the National Organization of Reform Marijuana Laws, NORML, a non-profit organization dedicated to reforming cannabis laws. In 1994, engineers of the Apple computer codenamed the Power Macintosh 710 Carl Sagan. They hoped the Apple would make billions and billions with the sale of the Power Mac 77. The name was only used internally, but Sagan was concerned that it would become a product endorsement and sent Apple a cease and desist letter. Apple complied, but the engineers retaliated by changing the internal codename BART to Butt-Headed Astronomer. Sagan also sued Apple for libel in a federal court. The court granted Apple's motion to dismiss Sagan's claim and opined in dicta that a reader aware of the context would understand Apple was clearly attempting to retaliate in a humorous, satirical way, and that it strains reason to conclude that the defendant was attempting to criticise the plaintiff's reputation or competency as an astronomer. and one does not seriously attack the expertise of a scientist using an undefined phrase, butthead. Sagan then sued Apple's original use of his name and likeness, but again lost. Sagan appealed the ruling in November 1985, and out of court settlement was reached in Apple offices, trademarks, patents, released accidentally statement. Apple has always great respect for Dr. Sagan. It was never Apple's intention to cause Sagan and his family any embarrassment or concern. Apple's third and final code name project was Law. Lawyers are wimps. UFOs. I don't know, that's stupid, isn't it amazing? In 1947, the year that inaugurated flying saucer craze, the young Sagan suspected the disc might be alien spaceships. Sagan's interest in UFO reports prompted him on August 3rd, 1952, to write a letter to the US Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, to ask how the United States would respond to flying saucers turned out to be extraterrestrial. He later had several conversations on the subject in 1964 with Jacques Vallée, although quite skeptical that any extraordinary answers to the UFO question. Sagan thought scientists should study the phenomenon, at least because it was widespread public interest of UFO reports. Stuart Appel notes Sagan, quote, wrote frequently on what he perceived as the logical empirical fallacies regarding UFOs and the abduction of in the abduction experience. Sagan rejected the extraterrestrial explanation for the phenomenon, but felt that there were both empirical and pedagogical benefits for examining UFOs reports, that the subject was therefore a legitimate topic of subject. In 1966, Sagan was a member of the ad hoc committee of the review of Project Blue Book, the U.S. Air Force UFO Investigation Project. The committee concluded Blue Book had been lacking in scientific study and recommended a university-based project to give UFO phenomena a closer scientific scrutiny. The result was the Cordon Committee, 1668, led by physicist Edward Condon. In their final report, they formally concluded that the UFO, regardless of what any of them actually were, did not have behave in a manner consistent with the threat to national security. Isn't that really? I don't know whether they're from outer space, but they're not threatening the United States. I like that. It's a brilliant, brilliant way of getting through. Sociologist Ron Wiesen writes, the high point of Sagan's treatment of the UFO question was the AAAS Symposium 69. A wide range of educated opinion on the subjects were offered by participants, including not only proponents of such James McDonald and J. Allen Kagan, but also skeptics like astronomers William Hartman and Donald Menzel. The roster of speakers was balanced, and it is to Sagan's credit that this event was presented in spite of the pressure from Edward Codden. The physicist of Thornton Page, Sagan edited the lectures and discussions given at the symposium. They were published in 1972 as UFOs Scientific Debates. Some of Sagan's many books examine UFOs as one episode of Cosmos and claimed a religious undercurrent to the phenomenon. Sagan again revealed his views on interstellar travel in 1980 Cosmos series. In one of his last written works, Sagan argued that the chances of extraterrestrial spacecraft visiting Earth was devastatingly small. However, Sagan did think it was plausible that Cold War concerns contributed to governments misleading citizens about UFOs, and wrote that some UFO reports and analysis and perhaps voluminous files have been made inaccessible to the public, which pays the bills. It's time for the files to be declassified and made generally available. He cautioned against jumping to conclusions about suppressed UFO data and stressed there was no strong evidence that aliens were visiting Earth, either in the past or the present. Sagan's paradox. Sagan's contribution. Now, I like it how he was able to work out the logic of not doing Star Wars. Now, here's another one. Sagan's contribution to the 1996 contribution on the attack on the belief of UFOs, upheld by extraterrestrial beings, applying several logical assumptions, the Drake equation, Sagan calculated the possible number of advanced civilizations capable of interstellar travel was about 1 million. He predicted that any civilization wishing to check on all the others on a regular basis, say once a year, would have to launch 10,000 spacecraft annually. Not only does it seem an unreasonable number of launchings, but it will also take all the materials in 1% of the universe's stars to produce all the spaceships needed for all civilizations to seek each other out. Okay, it's got a million, it's got a favor. To go to the Earth was being chosen for regular visitations, Sagan said it would be tough to assume that it was somehow unique, and that assumption goes exactly against the idea that there are lots of civilizations around, because if there are, then that sort of civilization must be pretty common. And if we're not pretty common, and then there are not going to be many civilizations advanced enough to send visitors. Oh, God. This argument, which is called Sagan's paradox, helped establish a new school of thought, namely the belief that extraterrestrial life exists, but it has nothing to do with UFOs. The new belief, salutary effect of UFO studies. It helped to separate researchers who wanted to distinguish UFOs from those who wanted to identify their pilots, and give scientists opportunities to search the universe through intelligent life, unencumbered by the stigma of associated with UFOs. Death after suffering myelodysphalia for 2 years and receiving 3 bone marrow transplants from sister, oh God, that would be bad. Sagan died of pneumonia at age 62 at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, Washington. Oh God, it's a long way across the other side of the US. On December 1996, burial took place at Lakeview Cemetery in Ithaca, New York. So that's Carl Sagan, and the reading of that took 1 hour and 1 minute. Thanks for listening.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.